morning, we're on the second half of the docket, and I know some folks were not here at the beginning. My apologies to those of you who were here at the beginning and have to hear this again. We have been able to resume our practice that we really enjoy of coming down and greeting council and shaking hands after oral argument. That said, if any of you would rather not shake our hands of concerns about infection, we will certainly understand that. Just nod, and we'll give you a little wave. Secondly, some of you may have your clients here with you, which is terrific. They're most welcome. But unlike a circuit court trial, the only folks who can sit at the table are the lawyers. So we'll ask if you do have clients here to have them remain in the gallery. And third, we no longer have sign-in sheets, but if you would be good enough to email Deborah in the clerk's office and let her know you argued the case, that way we'll have a record of who's argued the cases. And with that, the first case we have is Tom Tangsap versus Dr. Fonexi Mingusupana. I probably mispronounced that terribly, but it's Mr. Ader.
Yes, Your Honor.
For the appellants, and we have Mr. Pledger.
Yes, Mr. Pledger, Rich Pledger for Penn National.
Thank you. And
John Wilson
Wilson.
Who I will call defendant Ming.
Okay. And, gentlemen, are you planning to divide up the oral argument? You've got 15 minutes, or is one of you going to take it for both?
We were going to argue it. I was going to take the plea and bar, the first five plea and bar assignments of error.
Okay.
And Mr. Pledger was going to take the summary judgment, if there were questions on plea and bar.
Okay, that's fine. I just know you've got 15 minutes total, so whenever you want to stop and yield to your co-counsel, you're welcome to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Ader, it's Ader or Ader?
Ader.
Ader. Mr. Ader, come on up. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttals?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes, Your Honor. Thank you.
5 minutes, certainly.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ben Ader from the law firm Tate Bywater. I represent the plaintiffs, the Tangsap plaintiffs in this case. And I'm sure as you're aware, this is a little bit of a procedurally involved case with a background that involves several different counts. The factual allegations remain relatively the same among them. There are various changes that took place. The appeal assignments of error 1 through 4 involve primarily the issue of the tolling provision of the discovery rule, assignment of error 5 about the punitive damages, and assignment of error 6, which is the motion for summary judgment that was granted by Judge Fisher. And I'd like to address them initially first, the concept of the discovery rule, and then get to the motion for summary judgment part after that. And if there's questions, we can change the order. And thank you for making the time. This is my first time presenting before the Court of Appeals, so thank you very much. The primary concern relating to the first four assignments of error relate to the breach of fiduciary duty and the fraud counts and the tolling statute. This is a situation where the plaintiffs are Laotians who live in Thailand. They don't speak or read any English and are completely unfamiliar with any Western legal system. This was a sibling of theirs who died in the United States. A wrongful death settlement was obtained, and there was an executor, an administrator, who was appointed for the decedent. And the money that was received in the wrongful death case led to then the documents filled out for the estate with the commissioner of accounts. The distributions, as ordered by the court in the wrongful death case, had specific numbers identified for each of the parties. There was an issue raised in the police brief about counts 3 and 4, alleging that those were waived. I want to clarify for Your Honors that counts 3 and 4 that were voluntarily dismissed were of the third amended complaint, which were only counts raised by the new plaintiff, which was the administrator of the estate of the parents. So just to make sure we understand the details of this, it's a bit confusing. There are the beneficiaries of the decedent, siblings, and the parents. The parents died after obtaining the money from the wrongful death suit, but prior to the discovery of any of the fraud that took place. And so the third amended complaint is when the additional plaintiff was added, when we had somebody qualify in Fauquier County as the administrator for the parents who had deceased to allow them to be able to bring that claim. There was no voluntary dismissal of the fraud counts as relates to the other plaintiffs in the prior iterations of the complaint. The breach of fiduciary duty and fraud and conversion counts, all were raised by each of the other plaintiffs, were denied by the plea and bar, which was argued relating to the statute of limitations having run, and the argument about the tolling provision as relates to the discovery rule, we believe did not get addressed by Judge Fisher as is appropriate. And the Dennis v. Jones case indicating that it would need to be under the particular circumstances of this situation as to whether or not there was due diligence taken by the plaintiffs that would allow for the tolling of the statute of limitations. There was no evidence taken. The only evidence is related to the court's decision at that time were the allegations in the complaint. We believe that it was an inappropriate decision to say that there was no due diligence when there wasn't a discussion as to what efforts could have been made or were made by parties who...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm still processing something that you just argued about why we shouldn't find that the consent order where it was agreed to dismiss counts 3 and 4 with prejudice. This is the order ended in May of 2023 by Judge Fisher on the in response to the third amended complaint. You're saying that that does not bind all the plaintiffs here. I'm trying to understand why, because all the plaintiffs are listed in the third amended complaint.
But not for that count. Counts 3 and 4 in the third amended complaint specifically states in the wherefore clause that that cause of action is only being sought by that newly appointed plaintiff, which is the administrator for the parents. And that's the distinction that I think I didn't clarify very well. The prior counts 3 and 4, for fraud and breach of fiduciary duty and conversion, those ones that were dismissed on the plea and bar were by all plaintiffs. In the third amended complaint, where we agreed to dismiss those voluntarily, those specifically stated in that amended complaint that those counts were only on behalf of the newly added plaintiff. And I think that's an important distinction because that would mean that the agreed order to dismiss those counts can't then be retroactively applied to plaintiffs who were not alleging that complaint in that version of, in that complaint, the third amended complaint. They were parties to that cause of action. Their attempt at filing the breach of fiduciary duty and fraud counts were in the original complaint and the amended first amended and second amended complaint. Those were the times when the plea and bar was granted over our objection because the court did not believe that the discovery rule should apply.
Got it.
I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
And with that distinction, I believe that that leaves us in a situation to still make a determination as to the decision by Judge Fisher to grant the plea and bar over our objection that the discovery rule should not apply in that situation, wherein the parties who were Laotians living in Thailand, completely unfamiliar with the Western legal system, who did many actions to try to contact the administrator. In this context, we have to keep in mind, Your Honors, that the administrator of this estate made specific efforts to conceal from the beneficiaries the amount of the settlement, concealed the accounting records, concealed from them any information relating to the money that they should have received, and then additionally concealed from the Commissioner of Accounts the process by which he was planning to provide them that money, which was, again, through himself as power of attorney. And that then leads into the assignment of error 6, which relates to the motion for summary judgment, which was granted, and which involves the distinction that the appellants emphasize between the role of Dr. Mingsisupan, who was the administrator of the estate of Prachom Thengsat, the decedent. He received the money and was supposed to faithfully administer those funds to the beneficiaries. He failed to faithfully administer or perform almost any of his duties, but the appellants believe that because he also had obtained powers of attorney for the purpose of obtaining the wrongful death settlement in court, as required by statute, which I acknowledge, that then means that when he signed the front of the check, having concealed to the beneficiaries what amount of money they were supposed to receive, having concealed to them any accounting or notices relating to the estate, he then flips the check over, puts on his hat as power of attorney, and signs as their agent and deposits the money into his own account and uses it for his own free will, giving only $20,000 of the $410,000 to the beneficiaries. We are led to believe that that line of demarcation is the moment when the check is flipped over, he's now changed authority, and that there was no breach of any fiduciary duty, there was no falsification, or any problem with any of the accounting that took place as administrator, and the only wrongdoing was later and subsequently under the authority of the power of attorney. My concern with that is that we're believing, and not having taken evidence, because this was a grant by motion for summary judgment, we don't have sufficient evidence to determine whether or not, first, when the powers of attorney were obtained in Thailand, in Bangkok, with these plaintiffs, that anything was discussed as to the purpose of those powers of attorney. Was the intent for those powers of attorney only to be used for the obtaining of the wrongful death settlement as required by statute in front of the judge? Was there discussion as to whether or not that power of attorney would then be subsequently used for any further distributions, or was his authority as administrator of the estate meant to be what's used to distribute the funds to the beneficiaries? Subsequently also, we don't have evidence as to the actions that were taken by Dr. Mingsisupan as administrator. He opened accounts under his own name. He had made some sort of plan by concealing the records from the beneficiaries, and there's other conduct that we believe would have been able to demonstrate fraud under his authority and capacity as administrator of the estate. But by simply saying the then later result of him stealing the money, that was done under the power of attorney, there was no actions taken by him as administrator to support that. And that's where...
Would you agree with your colleague for Penn National that their responsibility only, surety only extended to the actions as the administrator of the estate and not as the power of attorney?
I would agree that that is the case, but I would not agree that we had enough evidence to determine what actions were done as administrators to whether or not there was misconduct. For example, in the Mackey case, and I think the Collins case as well, there were citations to being very factually similar, where some agent as a administrator and as power of attorney took the money as attorney in fact under the power of attorney and then subsequently used it for wrongful purposes. They alleged that because of that next step was done under other authority, it's not under the bond or the insurance as administrator. But in neither of those cases were there any allegations of misconduct as administrator. Whereas here in this case, there are elements or facts or conduct that support and aid in that fraudulent act as attorney in fact. So if we're to say that the administrator of an estate can do anything they want, as long as the final step of them cashing the check for themselves was done under the power of attorney, then they're free and clear of any liability. Whereas I don't believe that that's what those cases are standing for.
You are into your rebuttal time. If you'd like to continue, feel free, but if you want to save your time for rebuttal.
Just one final point then, Your Honor, that I don't believe that the distinction here is just purely about which hat he's wearing, but about the criminal intent or what misconduct might have taken place as administrator that supports the scheme that was obviously in place at that time that he was planning to execute under the hat of power of attorney. Thank you, Your Honor.
May I please the court, and good morning. My name is John Wilson with the law firm of John S. Wilson, attorney at Law PLLC down Norfolk. In terms of the pleas in bar, the discovery rule he never actually addressed. He simply reiterated attorney argument and didn't bring out the fact that on a plea in bar where no evidence is introduced, you rely on the allegations in the complaint. And here, the allegations in the complaint, anyone you choose, I'll use a third one as an example, they say that they had a person who was, as paragraph 22, who was their liaison with the United States. And they would be calling, and they would be texting. And their issue was, well, we never got a response. But that doesn't mean that they exercised due diligence. They could have gotten a response. Maybe they could have called the court. Maybe they could have done a lot of other things. But simply not to include that in the plea in not to include those allegations in the complaint don't establish the discovery rule. Plus, the discovery rule does not apply to the breach for fiduciary duty. We cited the case of Birchwood versus Manassas case, as well as a whole line of federal cases and Virginia case law as well, that says that the discovery rule does not apply to fiduciary duty or conversion, because they list 249, 8.0 and 249 lists the causes of action which are tollable, if that's such a word, and those are not amongst them. So the discovery rule simply is not going to assist them in this case, and those causes of action were properly dismissed by the judge. Not only the fraud was properly dismissed three times. The first time it came around, that came around again, that came around in the third amended complaint, and then they finally said, we'll dismiss it with prejudice, and so it was dismissed with prejudice, fraud and conversion. But they've got a bigger problem. They've dismissed the entire third amended complaint in the final order, and they don't have any appellate points against Dr. Ming to undo the finality and the conclusiveness of their dismissal of the third amended complaint.
What
in the final
order. What do you say to your colleague on the other side's argument that the dismissal of counts 3 and 4 from the third amended complaint was essentially just limited and cabined to the application only to the essentially the parents' administrators of the parents' estate and didn't apply to the other plaintiffs?
As I said, counts 3 and 4 were dismissed, and those were fraud. We didn't read it that way. We intended that, because we're going to move for sanctions at that point if they continue to keep bringing the fraud claim, because the fraud claim had been, it was clearly time barred. And it's not, remember, this is an action to falsify and surcharge an account. And they never actually pursued that cause of action. And that's the one that would give them a 10-year statute of limitations. That's one that would give them the right to go after the bond. But they call count one, they call it action to falsify and surcharge an account, and then try to graft upon it all these common law theories, which the trial judges were dismissing because they were time barred. And so I'll let Mr. Pledger respond to this. I'm taking a lot of his time. I'll let him respond to the summary judgment issues, but I'd be happy to answer any questions on the plea and bar if I've not done so to your satisfaction. But I would emphasize that the plea and bars were properly granted based on statute of limitations. As to the fraud cause of action, that would be the only one to which the discovery rule would apply, and there are no allegations in the complaint that would show the assiduous due diligence that they were required to show. In fact, they show that they were in contact with the people they need to speak to. So I think the judge properly dismissed it, and dismissed it three times.
Thank you. Mr. Pledger, come on up, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Good morning, still. My name is Rich Pledger, and I represent one of the appellees, Penn National Mutual Casualty Insurance Company. Penn National requests that this court affirm the lower court's decision on June 6, 2023, which is the order granting summary judgment in favor of Penn National, all for the reasons set forth in our brief. Penn National requests that the court affirm the decision, first because Penn National only bonded Dr. Ming in his capacity as administrator of the estate. And it's clear, based upon what the bond language says, that that's what it is. He did not, nowhere in the bond does it refer to bonding Dr. Ming in his capacity as a attorney in fact under the powers of attorney. Second, there are no issues of material fact generally in dispute which would affect the judgment below. And third, the appellants agreed to endorse the consent order, which Mr. Wilson has already referred to, on May 12, 2023, voluntarily dismissing the fraud and conversion claims with prejudice, which took out Dr. Ming, but it was not appealed and is final and conclusive. To permit the rule that the bond covered Dr. Mean in his capacity as attorney in fact under the power of attorney would basically foist upon Penn National an obligation which it did not bargain for. And had no control over it, knew nothing about it. The trial court correctly found, and the U.S. Supreme Court found in Mackey versus Cox, nowhere in this case do the appellants say that the amount Dr. Mean put into the account for the family was wrong. And appellants correctly stated in their opening brief that it follows that immaterial facts generally in dispute or material facts not generally in dispute do not preclude the entry of summary judgment. I think it's important to distinguish between two primary cases. One is the Mackey case, which, as I've stated, I think fairly succinctly in our brief, is pretty much on all fours with this case. But the Grubb case is the one that the appellants rely upon, and the Grubb decision describes an evidentiary presumption, not a basis for a claim cause of action. And that is, they claim that as administrator, Dr. Ming distributed funds to a party who knew was planning to steal the money. Now, those are allegations peppered throughout the complaints, the briefs, but there's no evidence. There's absolutely not one stick of evidence suggesting that that is the case. There were no depositions taken in relation to that. There was no written discovery along those lines. There's just no evidence. They said they cite the Grubb case for the proposition that any transaction that an agent by durable power of attorney consummated to his own benefit with principal's assets while acting as principal's fiduciary is presumptively fraudulent. Again, Grubb describes an evidentiary presumption, not a basis for a cause of action. The presumption, like any other evidentiary presumption, merely shifts the burdens of proof, the burden of proof of both production and persuasion, which is then clear and convincing evidence. When a presumption of constructive fraud arises, the burden of proof shifts to the fiduciary to produce clear and convincing evidence to rebut the presumption. It's important to distinguish the facts in Grubb with the facts of this case. In Grubb, the executor deposited estate money into account that the executor held jointly with the estate. Now, probably was Mr. Adam, I don't believe he picked up on that point. In our case, the fraud and conversion causes of action were and also in Grubb, with respect to the Highland certificate, which was purchased after Ernest obtained Logan's power of attorney, admitted that all the money was used to purchase the certificate came from Logan's assets. So he did take assets based upon his role as the power of attorney. And then basically it spilled over into the administration of the estate. In Grubb, the chancellor found that the remaining seven accounts for a total of just over $239,000 were created by Ernest using his power of attorney, and thus his actions involving those accounts were subject to a presumption of constructive fraud and a presumption that a claim for breach of fiduciary duty under the power of attorney might exist. There's no question that if Dr. Ming in fact did what they suggest he did under the powers of attorney, that there may be a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty under the power of attorney. But that does not spill over into the bond for the role as administrator of the estate. The funds, there's no question that the money allegedly misappropriated made it to the family account as the power of attorney. As the administrator. So in this case, looking at the timeline, Dr. Ming received the wrongful death settlement proceeds in the amount of $390,000 as alleged in the Second Amendment complaint. That was on January 28, 2015. On January 30, 2015, Dr. Ming received all of the assets of the estate on behalf of each appellant and deposited them with another $10,000 into the family estate for a total of $402,000. Then, after he made that transfer, acting in his capacity as administrator of the estate, Dr. Mean issued checks to each appellant in the amount of $402,509.44. And then, acting in his capacity as the attorney in fact, turned the checks over and endorsed each check, signing his own name and writing under each signature, attorney in fact. So it's clear that he purposefully exercised his duty as an administrator in writing the checks and then depositing them into the family account as the under the power of attorney. Now, if and the commissioner of accounts, when he took the accounting, acknowledged that all of this was done on January 30, and then any misappropriation of any of the assets, if in fact there were any, occurred after January 30. And January 30, as Judge Fisher asked in the argument on summary judgment, what is the line of demarcation? When do you move the hats around? The line of demarcation was the moment that Dr. Ming exercised his responsibilities as administrator of the estate to dump the money into an account as for the benefit of the family and as the attorney in fact, power of attorney. I'm not going to repeat what Mr. Wilson has stated, but there were a number of things that troubled me as well. The appellants seem to suggest that Dr. Ming formed an intent prior to receiving the monies to misappropriate the funds and spend them for himself. Well, first of all, again, there's not one lick of evidence that he formulated that intent. There were no interrogatories along those lines. There were no requests for admission. There were no depositions. Unfortunately, Dr. Ming is now dead. He's not going to be able to get those issues along. So, I don't see how they go to prove there's a lack of evidence of any intent to form a mischievous type activity. And at the end of the day, it really wouldn't make any difference if he formed an intent. The question is what he did as the power of attorney and as the administrator. He only acted on whatever potential intent that he formulated after the monies were deposited into the family account. I see that my time has expired, Your Honor. I simply request that the court affirm the lower court's order in favor of Penn National for the reasons that we've stated in the brief and as I've articulated today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Avery, we've got nearly 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to address these issues in reverse order so that it's still recency of mind with the things addressed.
Address the, yes, the allegation that you didn't preserve these arguments?
Which arguments?
On the plea and bar, on the first component.
So for the plea and bar, we preserved the argument relating to the discovery rule because the order, which you may believe was entered in November 15th of 2021 by Judge Fisher, which granted their plea and bar as to the breach of fiduciary duty and fraud counts. Those were objected to in the order. I objected based on the pleadings and argument So I don't know what else I would have done at that point to preserve that argument when those counts were dismissed, which were the ones against the remaining plaintiffs. As for the plaintiffs who was the administrator for the parents, I already acknowledged that that was voluntarily dismissed subsequently in the third amended complaint. So I don't believe that there's a concern of preservation of that argument. I think the confusion may have been as to which amended complaint or at what point what plea and bar was granted. The earlier plea and bar is different because it was different plaintiffs. The subsequent plea and bar is a different plaintiff and was voluntarily dismissed. So to address some of the issues raised by Mr. Pleasure, I think that the confusing part to me is that this is a question as to whether or not motion for summary judgment was appropriate, and yet he keeps raising that there is not one lick of evidence or that there's not evidence that was obtained. And he's correct. Dr. Ming died before I was able to take his deposition, but I do believe that there would have been other sources of evidence as to his conduct that could have been considered fraudulent under his role as administrator of the estate. For example, any actions taken at the time to set up various bank accounts. He said that it's clear that all the money went to the family's bank account. There was no bank account in their names. All the bank accounts at BB&T were in Dr. Ming's name and under his Social Security number. The only accounts available were first the account for the estate, and then he transferred it to another account, which was in his name alone. And then subsequently, there were his personal checking accounts, which received various hundreds of thousands of dollars. The only amount of money that actually made it to Thailand, translated into their, converted into their currency, was $20,000. So I think that the concern here is that it's not that there isn't any evidence available that could have been useful that would negate the need for motion for summary judgment. It's that we hadn't yet been able to take that evidence. My clients had already purchased tickets and were on way to be there for trial to testify as to the things that were said to them, and we were going to cross-examine the assistant and secretary for Dr. Ming, who assisted in taking certain steps as administrator of the estate. I think all of these things are questions that remain outstanding as to whether or not there was some breach of fiduciary duty or fraud or any other element. Now, to address the question as to the line of demarcation, what seems to be presented is an argument that in the moment that he switches and says that I'm power of attorney, all of those acts being fraudulent, that means he's in the clear as for the insurance. But when we're talking about a scheme of fraud, he set up bank accounts. He created the concealment. He withheld information from the plaintiffs. He also told the plaintiffs, which was alleged in the complaint, this is all you'll get after the $20,000. That was direct specific actions on behalf of Dr. Ming to conceal the information as to what amount of money they were entitled to. And those things were done as administrator. Just because the moment he withdrew the money and put it into his personal account is under the power of attorney doesn't mean that this entire allegation of fraud, breach of fiduciary duty, and the scheme that he came up with only took place under the power of attorney. There were elements of that, and there was conduct within that scheme that took place under his hat as administrator for the estate. And then to work my way back for the remaining seconds, just to address the discovery rule, there were specific allegations as that the evidence was concealed, and they did not take facts. As your honors know, a demurrer is different from a plea and bar. A plea and bar does allow outside evidence to make a ruling or determination as to whether or not due diligence was taken, and apologize for going over the time. I simply would ask that you overturn the court's rulings both for the plea and bar as to the discovery rule and the granting of the motion for summary judgment.
Thank you. Thank you. We will come down and greet counsel.
All right.